You're listening to Tingle Classic Movies with the King himself, King Ting. Michael Tingle, how are you, sir?
Oh, I'm fine. Yourself?
Doing well. Thanks for coming on the show. This is your fourth time, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Fifth, you know. 33, 34, whatever it takes.
Yeah, I had 7 beers. I had 8 beers. Whatever fits the narrative. But we got a really exciting show tonight. We're going to get into a lot of cool stuff. But, my friend, I wanted to bring up, first and foremost, we lost Ray Liotta last week, which I was surprised to hear that. I mean, young guy, the cause of death, I think, was heart failure. I'm not sure. I mean, who knows what people do in their personal life, but he's one of those guys I didn't expect to lose early. You know, he didn't, from what I know, he didn't have like a wild drug past or like, I don't know. It just, what do you think about that?
A friend of mine mentioned how bad he thought he looked in the Many Saints in Newark. Mm. I don't think I put it together. I just kind of thought he was grizzled down for the character.
Yeah.
But in thinking about it, I guess he did kind of look pretty roughed up. I don't know. I don't follow Hollywood as closely as I used to, but I don't think it was known that he was sick. At least I didn't know he was sick. Like you knew Bowie and Harrison and you know Harold Ramis were sick for a while, but like I didn't know if he was sick. He just kind of died in his sleep or whatever. It's sad.
Yeah, it is sad, and that's true. And you don't know. And I'm the same way. Like, I don't really follow it as much as I used to, but there are some people, some actors, some musicians that whether they're going through addictions or they have like HIV or something, they'll keep it totally private. Like Freddie Mercury was like that. He didn't reveal he was sick till like right before he died. Even though he was really sick for a while, like a lot of people will just keep that like private. Chadwick Boseman did that. He didn't reveal he had colon cancer till like right before he passed.
Right.
And so I'm curious about Ray Liotta. But I thought what you did when I saw Many Saints of Newark, which was, I wasn't blown away by it, but I thought like he was just kind of grizzled down for the role.
You know?
But looking back, maybe he was sick. I saw some pictures of him with his like fiance and he looked kind of like, there were like pictures taken when they were like leaving breakfast in the morning and he looked kind of disheveled, but I just chalked it up to like, you know, he's an older guy and it's like a Saturday morning. He's not like camera ready. He just probably rolled out of bed and like, let's grab something to eat, you know? So I don't know, but like, I'm sorry to see him go. I always remember him as most well, of course, as Henry Hill in Goodfellas and Shoeless Joe Jackson in Field of Dreams, which by the way, that scene where he hit the home run with Costner apparently was unscripted. Costner shared that on his Twitter and it tugged the heartstrings, man.
Oh, wow. Put it right here. That's right. You're a low ball hitter.
Low ball. Right. Exactly.
You know what I love? We talked about, baseball movies a couple weeks ago.
Oh yeah. We have to amend something. I'm sorry to interrupt.
We do.
Forgot to mention Casey at the bat, but I'll leave that till later.
Yeah. I love it when the people because I had that feeling when I was younger, all I wanted to do was hit. You know, I wasn't very good at much of the other stuff. I was a decent catcher, but by the time I got to high school, I didn't feel like catching. And I wasn't a good enough fielder to make the high school team, be it an outfielder or an infielder. So by not catching, I kind of screwed myself because, you know, there's only so many people that go out for the catching position. I'm getting off base here. But
it's the toughest position to play.
But baseball was like my first love. So when I see these people in the films, you know, like we were just talking about, you know, the Ray Liotta Shoeless Joe, like, put it right here. And he whacks the home run. And Kevin Costner's like, man, that's right. You're a low ball hitter, which I don't know how you would know that from somebody who was played in 1919, but whatever.
Good point. And that was the dead ball era, if I'm not mistaken, where.
Right.
you know, they use the same ball the whole game and it got all scuffed, that they'll just, those guys would just hit anything that came close.
And Ray Liotta just looks at the ball sailing away and he goes, God, I did love this game.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Roy Hobbs is sitting in the hospital bed talking to him, Glenn Close, and he's like, I wish my dad, God, I would love baseball. You know, I like that the characters, yeah, like it is, you know, they love this.
They like it as much as you like it as a fan.
Right. Hold on a second.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to the Podcastles, Tingle Classic Movies. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at @the_podcastle and Instagram at @thepodcastle. Shut up. We'd love to hear from fans, listeners at home and abroad. And it's a very fun, sexual time always on the podcast.
Anywho, sorry about that.
Oh, no worries. I agree with you. It's nice to see that as a fan of baseball. I love baseball. And we've spoken about this before. I even like the lesser known or not as critically acclaimed movies like Mr. Baseball and all that. I mean, they're all, unless they're terrible,
right,
they're fun rides. You know, it's a fun pastime. You can't really go wrong with a baseball movie unless you really kind of like screw it up. But I mean, they're not all great, but they're, most of them to me are, they're fun if they do it right.
They lend themselves well to film.
Mm-hmm. I think because it translates over the spirit of the game to people that might not even be baseball fans. Like A League of Their Own, I don't know the majority, but at least half of the people that still love that movie today probably aren't watching baseball on TV, or, you know, they just love the movie, the characters, and you know, they kind of get it. And what's so special about baseball is it's timeless. The rules are relatively the same. I mean, there's been a lot of changes, but relatively the same since the 1860s or whatever. And it's still done today. I mean, it really is America's pastime.
Right.
I can't think of anything that comes close.
Yeah. And, you know, everyone talks about low points and ratings and all that stuff. But I don't know, man. It keeps going.
Keeps going. They talk about it's too long. They want to make rules to, like, make it faster. And, like, yeah, I get that to a degree, but how long is it? 3 hours, 2 hours? I mean, that's a game. That's fine. You know, you go out, you want it to be a longer time if you're there in person.
Right.
Because baseball, to me, is always better to watch live at a stadium, where football is better to watch on TV. Because, you know, like, what's going on more on TV. Baseball, it's more fun to, like, be there.
Especially nowadays with football, everyone... At least everyone that I watch the games with, they have, you know, minimum 47-inch TV. Usually it's about 55 to 60 inches. You know, you're right there. The bathroom's right there. Your snacks are right there. Commercials, you know, if you're in fantasy sports or any of that stuff, you switch to, like, a red zone or the other game. And, yeah, you can't do that at the stadium. Baseball is nice there because it's so passive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, throw a pitch, you got a couple seconds, chat it up with whoever.
Right.
You can't. It's tough to do that at a hockey or a basketball game.
Yeah, no, you can't. You can go to the bathroom, get a hot dog, you know, baseball game. You come back, you look at the scoreboard. You're like, did I miss anything? Unless you're me. Which I always miss something whenever I do that. It's like a curse.
Even in the football aspect, like, I kind of hate how they're always trying to make rules for entertainment purposes.
Yeah.
Like, let's eliminate the extra point. You know, let's eliminate, you know, because everyone's going to get their beer at that point or whatever. Well, all right, well, look, I just watched the team march down the field for 20 minutes and they scored. I'm going to go get a snack. I don't mind, you know, you have 60 minutes of pretty darn good action. I don't mind that some of it is occasionally downtime.
I agree with you 100%. It's fun, too. It's fun to, like, walk around the stadium a little bit and see, like, what they're selling. And take a walk and see if maybe you can get better seats after the sixth inning or something like that. Like, it's fun to kind of do that. And baseball, I mean, where football, yeah, it's like you're going to miss something. And it's warmer too, you know, especially from Philly, you know, where you are and where I'm from. It's, you know, it's like nothing like a hot night at like Citizens Bank, where like an Eagles game, as fun as they are, I mean, you're kind of freezing. And if it's like a 1 o'clock game in January, you're up early on a Sunday. Like, to me, that wasn't like the greatest experience to go see a game.
Or if it's a 1 o'clock game on a September afternoon, you're burning up.
Yeah. Right. Like, yeah, you're burning up.
Yeah, those Philly, you know, it goes from fall to winter pretty darn quick.
Oh yeah. Yeah, the season.
Yeah. And man, I was at the Eagles Panthers playoff, you know, the NFC title game all those years ago.
Oh yeah.
Which was a dreadful game. I can still remember how friggin' cold it was.
Reason.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been to a few.
It was raining all day. It was raining all day. It was a cold rain. So you were kind of wet. Once the rain subsided, it was just windy and cold.
Yeah.
And then they went out and scored like 3 points or whatever the hell it was. It was like, man, this is awful.
That was against Carolina, right?
Yeah.
What was that, like 2000? What year was that?
2002, I think.
Yeah, right.
Right before they got, it would have been the 2002 season.
Yeah.
No, wait, I'm wrong.
It was McNabb though, and Andy Reid.
Yeah. Well, that was the game that convinced them to go get like Terrell Owens and stuff. So that would have been January of 04.
That's right. As much credit as I give McNabb and Andy Reid for their years in Philly and bringing us to the playoffs all this time, that was a tired duo, man, by the time they wrapped up. Like, people, like, what was it? I mean, it was like 2010, 2011, somewhere around there.
Yeah, McNabb was dealt at the end of the 09 season, I think. And then they had Michael Vick, who's like half beloved here. I still kind of like hold the whole what he did behind the scenes against them.
Yeah.
And I don't know. He was fine as a quarterback and whatever. They made him like a reclamation project, but Reed kind of like found the second life with him. And finally, finally he had it, but McNabb kind of got I guess they tired on McNabb before they tired on Reed.
Definitely. But
It was up. I don't know if you remember, it was up for debate for a while that, you know, Reed was going to be canned. He just took one
every game.
Every game, yeah.
YS or 6'10. What is it? What's 6'10 again? YS? No.
Yeah. And
YSP?
WIP. 94-1 now.
Every week, 94-1 or 6'10, it was always, are they going to fire Reed? You know, for like the last few years, people just wanted him out of town. You know, but I like Andy Reid for what he did for the city. You know, he made football fun. There was a lot of disappointment, but I mean, brought us to the playoffs more than any other coach at the time, I think. And I'm glad he found a second life in Kansas City. You know, he had his like personal problems with his kids and stuff. So,
yeah, most people that, you know, you hear talk about him have mostly good things to say. So,
yeah.
All right, my book.
Yeah.
And you're right. That kind of, you know, he took over. We were like 19, 20. It kind of boosted boosted the Eagles' love during that time. So we had just come in like those bad Ray Rhodes years.
Ray Rhodes, Rich Kotite. And then, I mean, those were what I call like the dark years, like 92 to 97 or whatever, when you had Rich Kotite, Ray Rhodes,
Rodney Pete, and like Jim McMahon quarterbacking.
Oh, they were bad, man. Yeah. I think Ray Rhodes was probably the worst. He just didn't like try. It was just, I mean, he tried, I'm sure, but those were like the dark years. It was like post Cunningham, or the tail end of his career, and it was bad. Great uniforms, though. Great uniform. I love the early 90s Eagles uniforms.
Hey, I'll tell you, the
Ellie Green.
I know people love the like the powder blue Charger uniforms and the orange creamsicle Buccaneer uniforms and all those shits.
Oilers.
The Oilers. I will stick to, I will die on this hill, the best uniform ever. The meanest looking MFers ever were the 91 Eagles defense with those silver pants, the Kelly Green jerseys, and the black shoes.
Oh, yeah. 100 pants down. Jerome Brown, number 99, wearing that. Like, you see those guys lining up on defense. I mean, it was menacing. And the coolest color scheme, too. I could do without the Tampa Bay, what you call it, the like popsicle orange.
Yeah.
I get it. Like, my dad used to live in Tampa. I used to go down there. We watched games. Like, it was kind of cool to see like a pirate in the orange, but hands down, agree with you 100%. Eagles, with the black shoes and everything. It was menacing.
Yeah, people going for those like teal like uniforms. Like, I mean, the Dolphins is kind of one thing. They've always been that, and I guess they always will be.
Yeah.
I don't know. I like them. I grew up half a Dolphins fan because of Dan Marino.
You've mentioned him. You're like, he's like one of your childhood heroes.
Yeah, man. My favorite quarterback ever.
They had a great team, man. Pete Stojanovic, the kicker that would do like 63-yard field goals.
Yeah, I remember for a while they had all those ex-Eagles. Keith Byers and Keith Jackson were on the team.
Yeah.
A couple other guys. And then
some good players. Mark Duper, was that Miami?
Mark Duper, Mark Clayton.
Yeah. Yeah, they had some players. They never won a Super Bowl.
Nah, they got there once and they lost to Joe Montana. So.
Thanks, Finkel.
Yeah.
but considering their history, the fact that they went there, I mean, if you're going to lose to someone, it's going to be Joe Montana.
Yeah. It's funny, man. Football. I guess it's because it's one day a week thing.
Yeah.
And, I just like crave it, you know?
Oh, yeah. You savor it more. You respect it more. And I think that's a big reason for a lot of people is baseball. You don't really watch every game. You catch the score. Nobody can really, unless you're like unemployed, you can't really watch every game because, you know, your team's on the road and they're playing during like a work day at one or something. Like, it's almost impossible. But football Sunday, it's like a tradition. And I believe, and I hope you agree with me, the day after the Super Bowl should be a national holiday. Like, the Super Bowl should be a national holiday, and you should honor it on the Monday since it's always on a Sunday. Like, what other holiday? It's like Thanksgiving in February. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, like I totally believe like that, and the day your team is eliminated from the playoffs, the day after you should be allowed off from work.
Oh yeah, yeah, to fight the depression.
Yeah, like, you know, when Paul McCartney passes, man, I ain't going to work for a couple of days. That shit's gonna hit hard.
Oh yeah, yeah, it hit hard when George Harrison died. You know, I was like, right. Oh. Yeah, I was in Atlanta then, visiting like my aunt and uncle. We were there, I think, for like Thanksgiving. I think he died like in November of 2001. And I remember I was like depressed. So I was, you know, I'm a big Beatles guy and I was 20 years old or something, 21. And I'm just like, this sucks. Like, we lost the Beatles.
Yeah.
You know? Those guys are getting old too, man.
I always tell my wife about certain people.
Yeah.
Harrison Ford and Robert De Niro. It's like,
oh, yeah.
Watch out, because I'm going to be like bedridden for a few days.
Oh, yeah. When they go, that's tough, man. And those guys are getting old, too. I mean, they are old, but, you know, you hope that they stick around for a while. Like, I look at the Stones.
Not old enough to not do Indiana Jones 5.
Is that going to be his, that has to be his swan song with Indiana Jones.
Oh, I hope it is.
What's that? At least
there shouldn't be any Shia LaBeouf, right?
No, I think they learned from that quick. And Shia LaBeouf was a product of his time, you know, because he was kind of like the it guy at the time. He was doing like Transformers and all these movies. They probably put him in there like, let's pass it up, you know, and make it So he's like the next big thing. And boy, that didn't age well. So I hope they learned from their mistakes from Crystal Skull,
right,
and kind of did that. But all right. So real quick, we talked about greatest baseball movies in the last show, and I forgot to bring up some shorts. And I wanted to mention Casey at the Bat. Disney,
yeah, man.
That's like a classic as a kid, you know?
It's I try to check it out every now and then. I mean, you can YouTube, but it usually pops up.
Yeah.
It's not on Disney Plus, or at least I haven't seen it on Disney Plus, which kind
it's of not. I know. Right? I look for it. I love the shorts they have on there when they do the old, like, Goofy will teach you how to ski, and the narrator's like, and then you start. Like, those are all like so much fun to me, but they didn't have Casey, and I'm like, how do you not have Casey at the Bat? It's a staple.
Right. And yeah. And it's the old time baseball. Like, I hope it always kind of lives on. As much as it was flawed, but you know, baseball now is not what it was back even in 1971, you know.
You're talking about the way that it's changed since 1971?
Yeah, I just mean those guys were immortal.
Yeah. You've watched Casey at the Bat like as a kid, right? You know, like it was always on like, the Disney Channel or something. I love those cartoons, those shorts, because they were from like the 50s, you know, a lot of them in the 40s, like what the truth about Mother Goose and all this stuff. And they were like enjoyable as a kid. And they're kind of still timeless now. So I think those old Disney ones are cool. You know, they have them like smoking and the narrator's just like, and today we're talking about the litter bug, you know, and it was always goofy. Like it was, they're supposed to be like educational, but they were fun.
And another short, I guess you could consider it a short that I wanted to get to for the baseball, but we didn't, was Homer at the Bat.
Oh yeah. Classic.
Yeah. Which is technically a softball episode, but you know, the Simpsons, Mr. Burns tries to buy his company's softball title. And,
right.
And, it, you know, it's one of the earlier episodes that really established the Simpsons. And,
yeah.
Can you run down the team? I can run down the team. If the team of ringers that he brought on. That bumped out Homer.
No, I can't. I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell you one.
Pitching was Clemens. Behind the plate was Mike Socha. And then around the infield was Wade Boggs, Ozzie Smith, Steve Strawberry. Darryl Strawberry was in right field, I think.
That's right. I remember
Steve
him.
Steve Sachs at second. And who was at first? Oh, Mattingly. And then in the outfield was Canseco, Griffey, and Strawberry. That was the nine ringers that they brought on.
That was it. Yeah. That's a good memory. Good call. But yeah, Homer at the Bat, man. That's a classic. All right, we're going to take a quick commercial break right now. We'll be back with Tingle Classic Movies just after this.
Chapter systems are offline.
Number one for today's hits and all-time favorites.
Get your steel shined up, grab a stick of juicy fruit. The taste is gonna move ya. Take a sniff, pull it out. The taste is gonna move you when you pop it in your mouth. Juicy fruit is gonna move ya. It juices soft, it gets right to ya. Juicy fruit, the taste is gonna move ya.
We're back on Tingle Classic Movies with the maestro himself, Michael Tingle.
No, I'm so honored to be here. It feels like only yesterday we were talking about movies, and here we are again talking about movies.
But Michael's a superstitious man, and if something should happen to his audio feed, whether it gets power knocked out by a bolt of lightning or his neighbor hangs himself in his jail cell,
it doesn't make any sense.
He's going to blame some of the people in this room.
That's so funny. To the listeners, Michael and I will go back and forth all day just quoting movies. And that's like my favorite thing in the world to do. It's just like...
Likewise.
It's just the best. I could do it all day. And there's no questions asked. It's just socially acceptable. You know who's like that too? Cooney. Cooney and I would do that.
Yeah. Yeah, we throw each other a bunch. I want all inquiries made. I want all acts of vengeance.
Isn't it? Like, Sonny's dead. Died in the causeway. What are we talking about? Yeah, so we did Casey at the Bat. I got to bring something up. You made a valid point about two. Am I allowed to bring these up on the air? Two movies that you brought up recently?
Yes. Can I make one more amendment, though, on the baseball?
Oh, yeah. Make 100 if you want. It's whatever you want.
I mentioned something about Judge Landis not really being in the way of desegregating the league. I want to clear that up because I don't want to give him credit for where credit isn't due. Apparently the report that I read initially was false. The thing with Judge Landis was that he didn't care, which I guess back in the day was just as bad as being against it. So his indifference led to no progress on the front of desegregation.
Oh, okay. And really, good to know.
Along with Jackie Robinson, the one that should get a lot of the credit is Branch Rickey.
I'm in the baseball business.
But from what I heard, Judge Landis was a strictly by the books guy, and he wasn't going to. And then that went for baseball and his time in the courtroom. So if it was written as law, that's how he looked at it. And he didn't have time, patience, or desire to change anything.
So
that's how he governed baseball. And that's why under him, under him, it's not surprising that we didn't break segregation because he wasn't going to stick his neck out for it, which, again, makes him just as bad as everybody else.
Yeah, it does. You're talking about Kennesaw Mountain Landis, the first commissioner of baseball.
Right. Great name, though.
Yeah, that's good to know, though. Thanks for clearing that up. Yeah, and he was also involved in he was commissioner during the 1919 World Series.
Right.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. Was he portrayed in any movies?
Just Eight Men Out.
Yeah, which is about the 1919.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know. It's a good tidbit there, too. So he was kind of just as guilty.
Yeah. I mean, if you weren't fighting the uphill, if you weren't ready to go all in, I guess you were just as bad as sitting back and allowing it to happen.
So he was commissioner in baseball for 2 years while he was still judge of the district court, appointed by Theodore Roosevelt.
Which is
interesting that he had those, because those are that like wouldn't happen today. You wouldn't have the commissioner of baseball also be a judge in Chicago, right? Because that's like a whole job.
Yeah, it seemed like his plate would be pretty full.
Right. And wasn't 1919 still the dead ball era league?
Yes.
Because dead ball, I don't even know where that comes from. Is that because they weren't like knocking home runs out then, right? It was kind of like they didn't have power sluggers then.
Yeah, you had guys winning triple crowns with 7 home runs. You
know? Yeah. Right. Yeah, it was like crazy.
I mean, they might 130 RBIs or 150 or whatever it might have been, but they weren't hitting the ball out of the yard.
No. And then I just want to talk, when I get older, I'm going to talk like Branch Rickey with a cigar at all times. I'm in the baseball business, and Jackie just wants to play ball too. So I'll let that slide. You're from the South. But listen, but yeah, that's a good tidbit. But I wanted to bring up with you,
not to do anything.
I need a player not to do anything. They came close today. Okay, so this was about Superman 4, I believe. And when I'm quoting Michael, and I'm going to let you explain. And Lois remembers his name, referring to Clark Kent. So his little kiss, you know, truck to N2, caused her to forget what she actually knows. Was that bullshit? And what was the answer? To do it all over again? So they kiss, they forget. So she has the same response. Are we meant to believe that if there were a Superman 5 or 6, that would Lois Lane suddenly remember this again? Like, there was a lot of inconsistencies. What is this whole situation about?
Yeah, I don't get it. Like, was it valid? Just because, all right, you get it at first. He plops the kiss on her, and it's, you know, he's magical, he's Superman, sure, whatever.
I get
it. She forgets. But she doesn't forget. So, like, no. So either four just took on some bad writing, which, I mean, we both saw four. Maybe it did.
We're talking about Superman 4, The Quest for Peace.
Yeah.
Or like Superman 4, Rest in Peace. That was a terrible movie. But amazing, too. It's always my go-to. I always go backwards.
Yeah, I mean, I remember back in the day because I just wanted to watch a superhero movie. It was new. I was 7 or 8. And,
yeah, of course.
You know, so be it. But yeah,
it's a terrible movie. But like as a kid, when that came out, that wasn't like terrible. I mean, it was another Superman movie. The budget was $18 million, which it should have been 36, but they slashed it. But that's still a lot of money. And by today's standards, that's still an $80 million movie. Like for what they had at a limited budget, you still got Christopher Reeve and like this, you know, Margot Kidder and Gene Hackman, like back, like those three alone. Well, at least those two alone. Margot Kidder, she wasn't like doing that great when they made that movie.
No.
You remember the fire scene, the fireplace scene where she's like,
yeah.
And then Superman just was to protect us. And she's visibly slurring her speech, and you're like, oh, she was like on drugs or something. Like,
yeah.
She was starting a show at that point. It was start. She was, there were some cracks you could see happening. Yeah,
had some issues. If you ever read Easy Rider's Raging Bull, which is like, it's an in depth doc, like book about 70s and. Like after cinema, after they broke the censors, like late 60s through about 1983.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
It was. It was a good book. I read it when we were, I guess I was probably in my early 20s. But I remember her parts. She was kind of perceived as, I guess for lack of a better word, a train wreck.
Yeah, it's sad.
So, yeah,
I used to have a thing for her, like when she was in I mean, this is before I was born, but when she was in like Amityville Horror and the original Superman, like Margot Kidder was pretty cute.
Yeah, right.
She was an attractive lady, especially Amityville Horror. James Brolin should be so lucky.
Right. James Brolin. You know what's funny now that I think about it? Remember I mentioned before about the Donner cut of Superman 2.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
I don't want to give away too much, but I guess in doing so, I am kind of giving away the ending here. But I mean, the movie is, even the director's cut came out 20 years ago. So it wraps up very similar to Superman 1 in that, you know.
Okay. I know, I guess, the ending of Superman 1.
Right. So I guess instead of destroying the three villains from Krypton, he puts them back in the Phantom Zone.
Yeah.
In which case she remembered what happened to her in one. She remembers, you know, he comes right. to the car and she's like, "Where are you? Where were you? I was getting dumped upon." And,
yeah.
You know, she remembers practically dying.
Right.
So if that's how it wrapped up, because there is no kiss in the Donner version. And if that's how it wrapped up, it actually ties in more.
Then it makes sense.
Right. But it's funny, that was, I don't even think that was Richard Lester at that point, right? It might have been Richard Lester. Did he do maybe. Three endings?
There were three endings?
No, I mean, did Richard Lester do three and four? I don't remember the direct.
No, four was, I gotta look it up because it's gonna bother me. But four was directed by Sidney Fury. Who I've done extensive research on the quest for peace since I watched it like 2 weeks ago. And apparently him and Christopher Reeve did not get along. Christopher Reeve was very critical of this movie and said it like killed his career for a while. Which kind of killed his career. He didn't do really a good movie after this. He did a lot of work, Village of the Damned and stuff, but he never really reached Superman level after that. Christopher Reeve kind of was a control freak and was like, well, this is the fourth Superman I've done. There's a way it needs to be done. And this new guy comes in by Canon Films. You know, they were doing like over the top, like those kind of movies, Cobra, you know, they picked up Superman and they were going to shoot a fifth one based on leftover footage from four. I don't even know how that would work.
Oh, wow.
But Sidney Fury, just to answer your question, directed it. So I don't know. There were some inconsistencies.
Would they have gotten Gene Hackman back for it?
Would they have?
Yeah.
Well, the idea for Superman 5 was going to be they in Superman 4, you know, when the Nuclear Man was created?
Right.
Well, there was two of them created, and there was actually deleted scenes of the second one. And the plot basis for a potential fifth film, and I don't know how this would work, would be the other Nuclear Man, which would have been a disaster because nobody wants to see the same Nuclear Man, like same actor, but a different character twice or something. But that's what the basis was going to be. But, you know, it got shelved because of the reviews. And they thought there was so much extra footage and the film was supposed to be a lot longer, The Quest for Peace, than it was. But Canon Films thought it was going to be such a big hit, like a huge blockbuster, that they cut so much out so that movie theaters could run it like three times a day instead of two.
That's so why it's an hour and 30 minutes.
Right. But that's wow. So that's why they had all this extra footage and they were planning on recycling that for a fifth one. But I don't know. Yeah. How that would work. But three. I feel like three in Superman is the last one I'll go to, even though it has like Richard Pryor. I'll go to one, two, and four before three, just because four is so bad it's good, kind of thing.
Right.
You know?
Yes, man. He came down and had the red cape.
The red cape. The Great Wall scene is my favorite. All of a sudden, he's like piecing back together the Great Wall in four. It's awesome. It's amazing. That's one of his powers.
One thing that is excellent about Superman in these films is he doesn't have to describe his powers. They just are.
They just are.
Yeah. I will say this, though. Like, the evil Superman scenes were excellent. And look back now, like, you would think that they wouldn't hold up. But there was something about watching Superman, like, get sloshed in a bar.
Yeah.
And, like, his powers to like break bottles and then fight himself to be like for the battle of the who was going to be the eternal Superman, like the good one or the bad one.
Right. Something cool. Special about that. It's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Superman 4 grossed $36 million off a budget of $17 million. So it doubled its profits. It made a profit, but I think the cat was out of the bag at that point and it was just, you know, just so bad. But yeah, just real quick, deleted footage. Apparently there were on the 2006 DVD, there's a gallery of deleted scenes and there's 45 minutes of the film that were added back in. And they were deleted following a originally a failed California test screening, and Nuclear Man, that appears in the film, the final cut, was actually the second Nuclear Man. So there was a first one. And I guess that's kind of why when Nuclear Man comes and he's talking to John Cryer and Gene Hackman, he's kind of like, and here he is. And he kind of just shows up without an introduction. Like they were used to seeing him, even though they didn't already in the film, because there was already scenes of like another one. Right. So it's kind of, I guess that's kind of what the idea was. I don't know.
Yeah. The name of the actor who played Nuclear Man, I believe. I'm not so sure of the first. I think it's Mark, but I know the last name. His name is Mark Pillow.
Oh, yeah. And that was his only acting credit.
Was it really?
Yeah. I think I read that. It was.
He was probably one of those like bodybuilders turned actors who realized he should stay in the bodybuilding world.
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't even have a Wikipedia page. That was like his only role. But but that's funny. And the other thing I wanted to bring up is Ghostbusters Afterlife. For me, this was a good movie. I never went into this movie with the expectation it would be as good as one or two, first and foremost, because there was no Harold Ramis. At least the actor was not with us anymore. And I felt like it was too long, and 2016 left a bad taste. So I was like, you know what? Jason Reitman's doing this. It's in the same spirit as Ivan. Let's give it a shot. And I felt like Ghostbusters Afterlife did hit on the right cylinders with nostalgia, in the sense that it gave me goosebumps to see Ecto-1 again and that brief scene with the guy I was in. But you brought up something interesting. And may I read this, or do you just want to get into it?
Yeah, no, go ahead. A friend of mine had mentioned this to me, and that's why it kind of, he brought it to my attention first, but it's noticeable.
Yeah.
Now when you think about it, but go ahead. Yeah.
No. Yeah. It blew my mind, and I didn't think about this when I watched it, but the things that you mentioned were, in Ghostbusters Afterlife, or the story arc of the kids and the mom. So you believe that they have issues with believing in ghosts, the kids. But this obviously shouldn't be an issue, because in Ghostbusters Afterlife, they're in the same universe as 1984. So there was factual events that happened that had ghosts. There was the Marshmallow Man that almost destroyed like Midtown. There were, you know, obviously plenty of ghosts and Gozer and all that stuff. So the fact,
right.
And that was on the news. There were crowds and news vans. They were on like Time Magazine and Larry King. So the fact that they didn't believe in ghosts is ridiculous, because
right.
You're in the universe. Why it would be like believing Reagan was never president, you know, today or something, or we didn't go to space. It's like, it's all right there in front of you. So that's ridiculous. And the second
one, the early stuff, like the Time Magazine stuff that you mentioned, like, all right, they were doing things behind the scenes, but the Marshmallow Man would have been well documented, along with the whole Gozer thing.
Yeah.
I mean, they had the National Guard out, for Christ's sakes, and it wasn't like they were covering up Area 51 or something.
There were crowds of people and news vans everywhere. Remember, they were chased by kids at the end of the movie.
Right. So there would be nothing not to believe. It would be like not believing in like an atomic bomb.
Right.
You know, we know they've been used. Whether they're going to be used again or not, who knows? But they exist.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's such a good point. And that's a huge plot hole. Like, looking back, it kind of hurt my feelings in the film that these kids like did not believe in ghosts. I mean, I guess a better thing to do would be have the kids like not care, like a typical kid today, like, oh, so long ago, they look cheesy or something. You know what I mean? Like, just make it so like it hasn't happened in 30 years, 40 years or whatever, like this.
Right.
Make them like not care. But the fact that they just didn't believe it, I mean, they were clearly watching YouTube commercials of them. There would have been videos of the news of the Marshmallow Man. I mean, even pre-cell phone, New York City, 1983 or whatever. There's going to be people that took videos and pictures of it, like in New York. I'm sorry. That would have been documented by the local stations. So that was out there, and that kind of hurt it. And then the second thing that hit home even more was Ray and Egon's relationship. You know, Ray was like, oh, I hope he burns in hell, or I hope he rots in hell, or whatever he said. They're fighting, And after everything they saw and been through in Ghostbusters 1 and 2, Ray, who believes in everything, all of a sudden in this movie, he's had too much of Egon's nonsense and doesn't believe about the stuff going in Oklahoma and kind of abandons him. I feel like Ray would have been like one of the first ones down there with him. Like, whoa, check out these readings. You know, we're getting all this. The EKG meter's firing up in here. Like that. Yeah. I don't know. That was a weird.
Yeah.
It was probably, they probably wrote it that way because Dan Aykroyd wasn't going to do an entire movie or something, but like it's.
And maybe Aykroyd just got a little lazy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's an older guy now.
Maybe not having Ramis there to kind of counter check him on the script. Maybe some things slid by. That being said, this is a character that Dan Aykroyd should know pretty darn well.
I would think so.
So
he played him in four movies if you include Casper.
Yeah, I was gonna say, well, Casper. There's another thing. I guess the movie's got a movie, right?
Right. But
in all actuality, the ghosts were weaponized. In all these films, they were threats.
Right.
If they don't handle Gozer, what's going to happen? If they don't handle Vigo, what's going to happen? So the first time we find out in 2 that they, you know, got stiffed on the bill by some bureaucratic, you know, schmuck like yourself or whatever Bill Murray says to.
I'm a voter. Shouldn't you be lying to me and kissing my butt? And bureaucratic bookworm like yourself.
So they got nothing there, but now it happened again. And at some point, wouldn't governments around the world be tapping them for security measures?
Right. Wouldn't you explore that even from a scientific standpoint?
And they really don't go into Winston's wealth at the end of Afterlife.
Right.
It seems like it does have something to do with Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
But
right.
It doesn't, like.
They don't specify.
Right.
You figured maybe he was like setting up Ghostbuster stations or sharing, creating systems or something like that, whatever. But they didn't. Right. They didn't tap into that. And to your point with, you know, we got stiffed on the bill as a kid. And even today, that it didn't like ruin it for me. And I forgot about it very quickly when I watched the movie, but that always kind of bothered me a little bit where like it's 5 years or whatever after the events in the first film. And then the second film, like all of a sudden there's no ghosts. Okay. Like maybe Gozer that got rid of him, but they kind of got written off as like, you guys are full of shit. And you know, like people just kind of forgot that they saved the world 5 years before. And I mean, that if that really happened, you'd be a celebrity for life and textbooks would be teaching about this. It would change everything. But they're kind of just like, you know, we got stiffed on the bill. Get them out of here, you know? Somebody get me a Ghostbuster. And it just kind of, I don't know. Did that bother you that they kind of like wrote them off quickly?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I was 9, I was just happy that another Ghostbusters film was made.
Yeah.
But ironically, when I was 40, I was just happy another Ghostbusters film was made.
I know. That was nice.
I didn't start digesting some of these things. Although technically they made another one when I was 37 or whatever with the ladies. But
yeah,
it could have been a lot better.
I agree. Yeah. That, I feel like that could have been a lot better.
I think 2 is underrated, and I think Afterlife was just nostalgia candy.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not going to crush it too much. It was simply, they rehashed a lot. I mean, they even brought back freaking Gozer, for Christ's sakes. Like, it was simply in the film about nostalgia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was all about nostalgia. And I even like 2 better than 1. 1 is a better film. It's a perfect classic. But 2, like, I just saw it more as a kid. I was, you know, like 9 when it came out. My parents bought it for me on VHS. Like, I watched it all the time. I just saw 2 more, and I don't know, I loved it. I thought, like, the pneumatic transit way was cool. Like, they're in this abandoned tunnel, and you know, they didn't use like the proton packs as much, but they didn't really use them that much in one either. There's a montage in the beginning, but they don't really do a lot of ghost busting in the movie. There's like a few little scenes in the beginning and then a lot of stuff in the middle and then like the big buildup. But it's all about the characters in those movies, which make them so great. But Ghostbusters 2 with like Vigo scared me and Janosch was ridiculous. And it was like a scarier movie, like in the train scene and the skulls and like the bathtub eating her. Like, I don't know. 2 to me was like just such a fun movie growing up that I still love it today.
You're right. It's not as good as it's not as good a film as 1, but it's
right.
It definitely gets underrated.
Yeah, I mean, Ghostbusters 1 is like what I consider a perfect film. It's got comedy, horror, religious stuff, like romance. It's like perfectly cast. It's just like a perfectly. There's not a bad scene in the movie. Where 2, you know, a lot of the stuff kind of grows a little tired, but you know, it's still fun.
You have Murray, and Murray keeps everything going. Boys, you're scaring the straights.
You're scaring the straights. Morons, your bus is leaving. That's Groundhog Day. But yeah, he does that kind of stuff. And I didn't understand the references as a kid, but as I got older, when he's saying like in Ghostbusters 2, you know, you'd be living the sweet life in Southern California's beautiful San Fernando Valley, which obviously is like, I live in the San Fernando Valley. It's like one of the hottest places in the world. It was clearly a joke by like the writers or something like that. And in the late 80s, I guess that was considered a luxury or something. But it's just like a lot of the references you get when you're older, when he's like, you know, oh, no, I have all new tricks. you know, you appreciate it more. Like, and yeah. The courtroom scene with the Scolari brothers is still like scary to me, you know? Like, it's just, it's fun. It's a fun movie.
But, all right, so the blackout was a big deal for everyone. But I turned into a dog and they helped me. Thank you, Lois. Short, but pointless.
I think she's more interested in my epididymis. Oh, just a friend, just something we're checking out. Raise a cult. 9 on weekdays, 12 midnight on Saturdays.
Pull my ears.
That is a great movie. I read the Ecto 1 in that movie was repurposed and used as the one in the sequel. Like the Ecto 2, I mean. Or the Ecto 1A, the one with the green lights, was repurposed as the first one because the original was like in a museum or it was destroyed or something like that. But I mean, I don't know. I don't know how much of that is true. I did like a deep dive and there was all kinds of conflicting sites. But what's your favorite Ecto? Ecto 1 or the sequel with the green lights and all that?
I still probably like Ecto 1.
Me too. It's too classic.
Everyone can relax. I found the car. Suspension.
Shocks.
How much? Suspension. Only 4,800.
4,800 in 1983 too is like
a lot of money.
Yeah, it's like 40 grand to fix up that thing today, maybe more. I still will hold my ground on this, but Ecto 1 is the coolest movie car ever. It's cooler than the Batmobile. It's cooler than the DeLorean. It's just the coolest car. You know?
Yeah, I may have to agree with you on that.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, most people, I think, go with that. If I argue with them or we debate, they give me the DeLorean. They're like, yeah, the DeLorean isn't like that cool. It just did cool things, but it was kind of like an 80s car. But
right.
the Batmobile is what I get. Like, oh, the Batmobile could do all this stuff. I'm like, yeah, but there was this white hearse or ambulance with the blue lights and the gunner seat and the Ghostbusters logo. Like, in New York City, like that's cool, man.
Yeah, Ghostbusters is like New York to me. You know,
perfect.
Yeah, and that was also weird about the afterlife. It was not set in New York, and it sounds like, you know, you're fighting redundancy here, but I don't know. Kind of doesn't it kind of need to be?
I thought so.
I don't want to see Spider-Man in Chicago.
No, not at all.
Spider-Man's a little kid from Queens or whatever.
Yeah, so, I. Yeah.
you know?
Exactly.
Like, at least for all the girls, for all the one the female cast got wrong, it was still in New York.
Right. At least. Right. And I feel like the, I'm sure the reason was money, because they filmed the whole thing in Vancouver, and to save money, New York is probably a fortune to film at. It probably like doubled their budget. But I feel like they should have done something in New York, you know, even if you're going to cheat it and film exteriors in New York, but do it on a set, like just having it in New York, what is what made part of Ghostbusters so great is they're in the Big Apple, you know? So I don't know. The Ghostbusters Afterlife, I felt like it's kind of a Shia LaBeouf thing. Not as bad though with Finn Wolfhard, like the Stranger Kids thing. Like they just put him in there. Maybe it'll age well over time, but
I hope so.
Yeah, I'll watch it again.
I'm gonna revisit it soon.
I think it's time. But I know we're running late on time. We can wrap it up now if you want to bounce.
Yeah, I mean, I'm good. I wanted to ask you, what was the difference between one and two? The one thing that one didn't, that two didn't have, that one had over, was clearly, yeah.
A central, like, scary character, like a Marshmallow Man.
Right.
Viggo was kind of weird. I mean, he was scary, but Marshmallow Man was iconic. He had this giant thing, and two tried to make up for it by having him in the Statue of Liberty, but I felt like they should have done like another giant kind of monster. And at the end, it was just this guy in a painting that was like a weird Scandinavian or Eastern European guy. And I don't know. I felt like that.
Much better music, though.
Oh, that's it. Hands down.
Yeah.
Even the Ghostbusters theme that they use at the end of two gets cut off after 20 seconds and replaced with like Bobby Brown.
Yeah.
You remember after they show them the painting? Yeah. And then they, at the end of two, they have the painting and they're like, maybe it's one of the, you know, fettuccines. And then they play the Ghostbusters theme. And then 20 seconds later, they cut to like, we're in New York and we're here to stay because the Ghostbusters here on a major way. And it's like, oh, like 89 clean rap.
Yeah.
The soundtrack was awful. It's like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles awful, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, the soundtrack I love because when I listen to it, I'm like, oh, it's that part of the movie. Like, this is great. Yeah. But like, Standing Alone, it's a terrible soundtrack.
Absolutely.
And Ghostbusters 2. I love
the, especially the one that runs at the end where they're just playing the clips through it. Like, you're messing with the wrong guy.
You're messing with the wrong guy.
It's such terrible music.
It's bad. Yeah. It's so bad. You're messing with the wrong guy. We'll have to do a whole show on Planes, Trains, and Automobiles one time.
We sure will.
Yeah, we'll do a Thanksgiving show this year. But that's a good question. The music, it was just so much worse in two.
Real quick, I guess Ghostbusters 1 is an origin story, technically.
Yeah, that's true.
As far as comic origin stories, I will die on this hill that Superman 1, at least the first hour, is still better than any of these other ones that came out.
100% agree with you. First hour, Superman 1 beats the rest of the whole franchise.
Well, I have a major question involving Superman's bodily functions and,
ooh,
like, he's in, you know, his dad puts him in that capsule for... He's in that capsule for a year or two, right?
Where's he going?
Yeah. How's he pooping and peeing?
He's not.
What's he eating?
Yeah. There's something wrong with that situation.
Yeah. I mean, or are we to believe that the capsule, and I guess Jor-El could have done this because he's like a scientist and stuff, but would the capsule have been self-nurturing?
That's the only thing I could think of, is it's like,
oh, thank you.
It's like an organic kind of life form that can nourish and absorb any like waste or something like that.
Right.
That's what it is. All right, but that'll be your time tonight, Michael. I want to thank you for coming on the show. As always, my friend, it's always a great pleasure of mine to sit and shoot the show with you. So please come back on soon, man. Let's do another one as soon as you can. These are a lot of fun.
I'm in. I'm always in. Anytime you need me, throw me a line and I'm there.
Just let me know. Michael Ting, everybody. Michael, have a great night, sir. And God bless you, my friend.
You too, Matthew.
Who you gonna call? Ghostbusters! If there's something